MacCast, Tuesday, May 10th, 2011. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Got a good show for you today. We're going to talk a little bit about Apple's response to the location tracking. I would call it a debacle. the scrutiny, location tracking scrutiny that they've been under. They sat down and talked to some of the members of the U.S. Congress about exactly what was going on, Apple along with Google. Also, some rumors about iOS 5 focusing more on voice. Of course, details on the new iMacs, getting into some of the nitty and gritty there. Looks like those new iMacs deliver some pretty nice updates. Also going to get to your feedback. Somebody wanted to know about adding non-QuickTime supported formats to iTunes. Little information on why your battery doesn't always indicate exactly or seem to indicate the exact amount of usage or time left that you have. And a cool tip on using spaces with multiple monitors. So stay tuned for that. But before we get started, I want to take a moment and recognize one of our show sponsors. Actually, welcome back to the MacCast, Gazelle. You may remember Gazelle. They're one of the fastest, easiest, and fairest ways to sell and recycle your old electronics. What's great about Gazelle is they allow you to avoid all the hassles of using online auction services or dealing with classified ads. All you have to do, if you're looking to upgrade a product, maybe you want to get something new, that new iPad 2, and you have an iPad 1, you just go on to the gazelle.com website. You do a simple search for the item that you have, and it'll go through their search engine. They'll ask you a couple questions about the condition, the types of accessories and items that you have with your device, and they will give you a straight upfront offer. You can take that offer, and if you choose to do that, in many cases, they will provide you a box, and the shipping is free on all items of value. The other nice thing is that occasionally they can't make you an offer on the item, but they can still help you out there as well because they offer recycling. One of the cool things that the founders of Gazelle did from the very beginning was they decided they're not going to make any money on recycling, but they're going to offer it purely as an add-on service. And they do it responsibly because their primary recycling partner is BAN certified Cloud Blue. They're one of the most respected names in domestic recycling. So you're covered either way. And when you're sending in your items for an offer, you're also covered because return shipping is always free. So there really is no risk to you. I want you to check it out. Just go over to gazelle.com. Start doing some searching on all those old electronics, those things that you have gathering dust in the back of your closet, and start earning some cash today. So welcome back to Gazelle, and a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. So you probably remember the big story a couple weeks ago was how some people called it location gate. Basically, Apple got in some hot water over some of the location data that was being gathered on iOS devices, and that data was being sent back to Apple. There was a back and forth on what exactly that data was, if it was actual GPS data. Apple came out and said, no, it's data that we've been gathering for building out a new traffic service. It's the Wi-Fi hotspot and cell tower locations. It's not personal. It's not identifiable. And now that some of this information has come to light, we realized there were some bugs in the system. One of the things they talked about was the fact that it was downloading or caching a large amount of data. Another concern was that it wasn't actually encrypting that data, and also that it was backing it up to iTunes when you ran your iOS backup. So Apple promised that they were going to fix that stuff, and this last week we saw those patches hit Apple's updates. So iOS 4.3.3 became available via iTunes. That's for GSM iPhone 4s, iPhone 3GSs, and all iPads. Apple also released iOS 4.2.8 for the CDMA iPhones, those folks who are on Verizon, and it addressed a number of issues, including reducing the size of that cache, no longer backing up the cache to iTunes, and now, when you turn location services off in the settings, it actually deletes that cache file and will no longer send any of the location data to Apple's servers for them building out that traffic database. So that has all been fixed. If you haven't run software update on your iOS devices, you can do that through iTunes, and you can pick those up. Now, somebody who wanted to know a little bit more about what Apple was up to and also Google was the U.S. Congress. They were actually called to a congressional hearing that happened today. It was led by Senator Al Franken, and Apple sent Apple's Vice President of Software Technology, Bud Tribble, to testify. Now, in his testifying, he basically restated a lot of what we had already heard Apple say when they responded to the press. But basically, they said that they were not sharing customer information with third parties without their customers' explicit consent, and also that Apple doesn't track users' actual locations and that they never have any plans to do so. They also said that the data on the iPhone was not the actual location data of the iPhone, but the cell tower and surrounding phone locations. So all the stuff we had heard before. Incidentally, Google sent Alan Davidson to the hearing. He's their director of public policy and government affairs. I thought it was pretty interesting to compare who Google sent versus who Apple sent. Apple sent their technology guy, one of their software engineers. And one of the things Apple did when this story came out was said, hey, look, we're a technology company. You know, we build great products. We're trying to do stuff for our customers. Google, it seems to me, has a little bit of a different approach. They sent their public policy and government affairs guy. So it was very different testimony. Although I will say, if you listened to or read through some of the transcripts, Apple was pretty much on the defensive saying, we weren't doing anything wrong and we rushed quickly to kind of fix these issues. Now you're going to have to decide for yourself whether or not you want to take Apple at face value. But Tribble did point out many of the ways that Apple tries to make the location information transparent to their users, reiterating things like the fact that all applications have to implicitly ask for location information. You get that pop-up alert saying, hey, we want to use your location. It is okay for us to send it. Location can be disabled for any app in the settings. You also get that little purple arrow in the menu bar to let you know when an application is actually accessing location data. So if you hadn't authorized it, you should have a visual indicator that that's going on. You also have that history in the location settings to see the little arrows by any applications that accessed your location in the past 24 hours. Some new information that came out during the hearing was he said that Apple apparently does random audits of applications after they're in the App Store. So beyond just doing the curating and approving the apps, making sure they're doing the things they're supposed to do and not grabbing location information without notifying you, Apple apparently occasionally will spot check different applications to make sure no changes have been pushed forward that have changed that. And they also said that they monitor blogs and developer communities looking for more information about potential violations. So if some other developers notice something or consumers notice something that shouldn't be going on, apparently Apple's also watching for those sorts of things. So they did say that if they find applications that are found in violation, they remove them within 24 hours and then work with the developer to fix the issue. And if it can't be fixed, then the application isn't put back on the store until it is. So that seemed pretty satisfactory in my mind in terms of how Apple is trying to protect this information. And they did state again that they patched many of the items that were of concern with the 4.3.3 and the 4.2.8 updates. And Tribble did also say one other item that many people had brought up was the fact that the data wasn't encrypted on the iOS device, that the cached location data was there. So if you had physical access to the device, you could potentially get at that information. Apple said in the next major release of the operating system, they will be encrypting that data. I will point out that if you currently use a passcode on newer iOS devices like the iPhone 4 or the new iPod Touch, that data is actually encrypted on the device. So just setting a passcode, you can get that feature now and not have to wait for Apple's next update. But I thought Apple overall did a fairly good job of responding to concerns and came off looking looking pretty good in the hearing. I kind of do personally take Apple at face value. I don't think they're trying to do anything nefarious with this data. I think they are more transparent than most other companies. Could they do a better job? Probably. And I think after this, we are going to see some changes, and this is going to get even more transparent. I'm not really sure what will happen with other companies like Google, but I think Apple is trying to do the best job that they can without impacting the customer experience. I think there's a balance between, you know, being too in your face about this stuff, because I think that at that point starts to really detract from the user experience. I don't want my iPhone constantly berating me saying, is this okay? Is that okay? Is this okay? I think we've seen that on Windows, and that's not a great experience either. So it's striking that balance and making sure that I think ultimately the consumers are in control, that I get to decide what happens with my location data and my privacy and stuff like that. And I'm willing to accept certain risks in exchange for certain features and certain conveniences. So I think as long as Apple can do that, I think it's going to be overall a good thing. And I think that's what they've been doing so far and will continue to do. We're starting to get closer and closer to WWDC. One of the major things that's going to happen there is Apple's going to show off Lion and the next version of iOS, iOS 5. Well, this week saw a bunch of rumors that Apple is in talks with Nuance, the makers of Dragon Naturally Speaking, and what used to be Mac Speech and is now Dragon Dictate for the Mac. And they're going to be rolling a bunch of voice recognition features into iOS 5. This is one of those areas where a lot of people point to Android and say Android's doing a much better job with voice commands and voice recognition and stuff like that. TechCrunch claims that the deals have been in the works for a while and that Apple is actually already using Nuance's software and maybe even some of their hardware at the North Carolina data center. So that data center is getting more and more functionality in it. We've got iCloud, we've got the iTunes Locker thing, and now we're hearing that it might be for some speech recognition technologies that may show up in iOS 5. If you remember, Apple purchased a natural language company called Siri, or an application developer who had a product called Siri. You can actually download it for your iPhone, and it's pretty cool. They bought that company back in April of 2010. What it does is it allows you to give it natural language queries and have it perform tasks for you. So you can have it make dinner reservations. You can say something like, find me a sushi restaurant near here. And then once you get the responses, you can say, oh, I want to go to this one. Can you make me dinner reservations at 7 p.m. on Tuesday? And it will integrate with services like OpenTable to actually make dinner reservations for you just by speaking this natural command into it. And the technology behind Siri is actually Nuance's technology. So it uses Nuance's speech recognition engine to do that. And that may be why Apple started the talks with Nuance. I would imagine they'd have to renegotiate those licenses because they were originally licenses that were done with Siri. So if all this stuff does pan out, it sounds like we're going to be getting a lot more speech functionality in iOS 5. Some reports I had read even said that's a primary focus or a primary feature of the new operating system. There were some rumors also that Apple intended to buy Nuance, but I think those aren't very likely. The current market cap on the company is $6 billion and rising. I think it's a little more money than Apple wants to spend, and they can probably get off a little bit cheaper by just licensing the technology. Interesting thing about all this is back in 1987, Apple actually had a concept and did a video for something called the Knowledge Navigator that sounds a lot like this. Now, it's credited to former CEO John Sculley, who rumors have it Sculley and Apple or in Jobs never really got along. Remember, he's the guy that kicked Jobs out. But the idea behind the Knowledge Navigator was that you would have these software agents that would access a large networked database of hypertext information. Now, back in 1987, we didn't have that. But hey, guess what? Today we have the internet, and we can, if we could query it through these natural language statements, that would be a really cool way to go. So voice recognition combined with Spotlight in iOS, along with these natural queries, I think would really make a powerful and very interesting operating system. And if it's integrated at the OS level and it's made available through APIs to other applications, who knows what kinds of stuff could be done. It could be really cool to see. And if I know Apple at all, it's going to be different than what anybody else has done. They're not just going to copy what Google's done. They're not just going to throw a layer of voice recognition on top of the operating system. They're going to do it in a really revolutionary way. I think combining this sort of natural language query thing with all these other technologies is going to be an impressive, impressive update. Hopefully we'll get a peek at that at WWDC. Another thing they're saying we might get a look at WWDC with iOS 5 is finally over-the-air updates for iOS. It would require some significant changes in the way that the operating system does its updates. You'd have to be able to install incremental patches rather than the whole entire operating system. I don't think downloading 400 megabytes over 3G is really the way to go. So that's something the operating system currently doesn't do. Obviously, backups would not happen before you applied the updates. So Apple needs to ensure that incremental patches and updates aren't going to cause problems. You would have the ability, I would imagine, to roll back to your latest backup if something went wrong, but you'd have to get back to your Mac to have that happen. So not really the best experience in the world. I guess they could go with some sort of over-the-air backup service through the new iCloud that we're hearing rumors about. That, again, gets logistically a little bit tricky, especially if you have to do a full backup. Maybe they could get away with doing incremental backups. So you'd back up to your Mac through iTunes, that backup would get uploaded to the cloud, and then when you were doing your over-the-air update, it could do an incremental backup of the operating system that's currently on the device, download any incremental patches for the OS update, apply the update, and then you'd be back up and running, and if anything went south, you'd have the ability over-the-air to reinstall the operating system. Don't know if that would be logistically possible. I would imagine you'd have to use Wi-Fi and not 3G if you had to do a full backup over the, or a full restore, excuse me, over the air. But I guess they could do it. Other phones and devices have been doing over the air updates. I'm not that familiar with them. I know Android's had it for a while. I have an Android phone, but I'm not sure I've run an update yet. So if anybody has any experience and has ever had any trouble with over the air updates, I'd love to know about that. Send me an email. Let me know how all of that works. Also at WWDC, Apple's expected to show off a lot more about Lion OS 10 10.7. And one of the things we're starting to hear, mainly based on the fact that Apple has been delivering developer updates of Lion to developers through their App Store, is that Lion might be the first no-disk OS 10 upgrade, meaning you'd purchase it and download it through the App Store. Logistically, I'm not really sure how that would work because, you know me, I like to do full clean installs when I get a whole new operating system. So I don't know if Apple would give a tool or an additional tool for me to create my own disk image, my own boot disk for doing a clean install, or if they're going to say, nope, it's simply a update installer and you run it over top of your existing operating system. I don't think that's the ideal situation. Maybe they do a hybrid thing where people could buy it either through the App Store or go into an Apple retail store and get a retail box version. I know that Apple has been including OS X, the operating system, on USB flash drives with the new MacBook Airs, since they don't have optical drives, and you can install from that. So that's a really cool, if you've seen the picture of it, it's a really cool little Apple USB stick. I want Apple just to sell those in the retail stores. I'd like to just buy one to have, but I think it's more likely that they might sell the retail box product with the little USB key rather than selling exclusively through the App Store. At the very least, they are gonna have to give me some way, if I'm gonna buy it virtually or without a disk, to build a boot version of the operating system. Maybe an update to disk utility in OS X Lion can make that feature available, but we'll have to see. Maybe we'll hear more about that at WWDC in June. As expected last week, Apple did release an update to its iMac line. Some of the highlights, they feature the new Intel Sandy Bridge processors in the quad-core configurations, new AMD Radeon graphics, along with Thunderbolt ports across the board, also FireWire 800. They have the newer FaceTime HD cameras and all come with 4 gigabytes of memory standard. They're still the same sizes, 21.5-inch or 27-inch. Prices also remain the same, starting at $1,199 US and going up to $1,999 US. On the 21.5-inch models, your processor choices are a 2.5 gigahertz or a 2.7 gigahertz Intel quad-core i5 processor. The display resolution is 1920 by 1080 pixels on the 21.5-inch models. The 27-inch models take the display up to 2560 by 1440, and they offer either a 2.7 gigahertz or a 3.1 gigahertz quad-core Intel Core i5 processor. Other cool thing on the 27-inch model is you actually get two Thunderbolt ports. iFixit quickly did a teardown of the new iMacs, I think same day. They were available on release day, so you can go to your Apple retail store right now and pick one up. But what they found out is that the GPU and the CPUs are removable. They appear to be on removable boards. In the case of the GPUs, it looks like it's an MXM, a Mobile PCI Express module. My guess is that Apple has had a lot of issues lately with graphics processors in various Macs, and in most cases, they had to replace the whole logic board because those things were soldered on. So I'm thinking that by putting it on a card and making it removable, it's going to make it a lot easier to repair those models or replace defective cards, saving Apple a lot of money. It's probably getting pretty costly replacing all those motherboards. I know my MacBook Pro actually has an issue. I've had the motherboard replaced twice, and it really needs to go in again because I'm continuing to have some graphics issues. So I think that was a smart move on Apple's part. The 21.5-inch iMac can apparently only use up to a maximum of 4 gigabyte SODIMMs, according to iFixit. So that means your total RAM in that model is up to 16 gigabytes. On the 27-inch iMac, they can take the 8 gigabyte DIMMs, so that's a total of 32 gigabytes of RAM. Another thing that was noted in some of the early reviews is some sites noticed the 3 internal SATA ports on the new iMacs were running only at 3 gigabits per second maximum rate. Now, that would be the 2.0 standard. Apparently, the newer MacBook Pros that just came out a few months ago were able to run the 6 gigabit per second SATA 3.0 spec. So a lot of people were wondering why the iMacs were throttled down. Well, a firmware update reportedly fixed the issue, at least for the two main ports on the new iMacs. So that brings them up to the 6 gigabit per second spec. The optical drive port stayed at 3 gigabits per second. So just something to note there. Another interesting thing that was added to the new models is an ambient light sensor, something that hadn't been there before. It's just to the left of the FaceTime camera and allows the display to do the same kind of dimming, auto dimming that you can get on the notebook models, the MacBooks and the MacBook Pros. Apparently, Apple has been quietly upgrading the Wi-Fi in some of the newer model Macs also. I guess the MacBook Pros got this, and now these iMacs are able to do Wi-Fi up to 450 megabits per second. What they're doing is adding an additional antenna to the AirPort card. So that means it can do three channels of data at up to 150 megabits per second per channel. You need a current generation AirPort Extreme or Time Capsule to actually make this possible. And you need to connect it over 802.11n in the 5 gigahertz band and also turn on the simultaneous broadband mode. But if you do that, you can max out the connection. It's a theoretical maximum of 450 megabits per second, and you can do that with the new iMacs or the newer MacBook Pro family. iFixit also noted that Apple had early access, I guess, to a new Intel controller chip, the Z68 chip, which is designed for the Sandy Bridge 1155. The new iMacs appear to be the first systems to have the new chip. Its official release date is supposedly May 11th, which would be tomorrow as I'm recording this. And the big feature in that new controller chip that everybody's excited about is something called solid-state drive caching. It's a way that you can pair a smaller, cheaper solid-state drive with a traditional drive, and then using the controller chip, coordinate using the SSD as a cache for the spinning drive, a very large cache for the spinning drive, meaning you can offload data there and then access it. And that's really going to dramatically increase performance and data access or read access to information. Although, according to the reports that I read, the feature is not enabled in the new iMacs yet, something that I would imagine Apple could turn on with a future software update. And the new iMacs do have the option to pair solid-state drives and traditional drives, so it could be a feature that would come in very handy and could dramatically increase performance. As I mentioned, the new iMacs do include Apple's Thunderbolt port. That's going to be a consistent feature on all new updates moving forward. Apple's really put its weight behind Thunderbolt. It's their next generation connector technology for hard drives and displays. The one thing that I was wondering about, and I think a lot of us were, is will the Thunderbolt interface allow for booting? FireWire and USB allow you to boot your Mac. So if you use an application like I do, like Carbon Copy Cloner or Super Duper, and create a bootable backup of your Mac, that's something that you come to rely on. The new Thunderbolt drives are just starting to come out now. Once they are available, though, Mac Observer has confirmed that the Thunderbolt interface is bootable, so you'll be able to boot. So that's good news there. As far as performance goes on the new iMacs, early benchmarks are coming in, and the new systems seem to be, on average, about 15 to 20% faster than the prior generation models. That's a pretty typical speed bump when you see a refresh like this. And it's important to note that those numbers are benchmark numbers, but they are being compared against other benchmark numbers. So that will probably translate into a similar real-world performance bump when you're using applications and things like that. As I mentioned earlier, there's already been an OS update, macOS 10.6.7 update for iMac early 2011. 1.0 was released. It improves the reliability of Back to My Mac, resolves an issue when transferring certain files over SMB servers, addresses various minor Mac App Store bugs. I'm not really sure why new hardware would have an App Store bug, but there it is. Also, minor FaceTime performance issues have been improved, addresses the issues with the graphics stability and 3D performance in the GPU, improved external display compatibility, and improved Thunderbolt device support. Apple also did release a couple of updates for the latest generation MacBook Pros, MacBook Pro Software Update 1.4 and the MacBook Pro EFI Firmware Update 2.1. So if you have the newer MacBook Pros or a brand new iMac, first, congratulations. And then also you might want to grab the latest software updates. So that's pretty much what we know about the new iMacs now. If you've received one and want to give us a review, your impressions and things like that, please do that. Send along your feedback and your comments on the new iMac. I haven't had a chance to drop into the Apple Store yet to get a look at them. Obviously, they don't look too different from the outside, but there's enough changes, I think, to warrant dropping into the Apple Store and taking a look. And really, who needs more of an excuse to go into the Apple Store if you're a Mac geek? If you've been listening to the MacCast for a while, you know my typical stance on the whole debate of are Macs safer than PCs when it comes to viruses and malware. My stance is that it really comes down to the users. It's not the platform. You need to be aware and responsible for what you're doing on your Mac. And if you practice safe computing, then you're not going to get infected. It's like a lot of things in life. But this week we saw a new fake antivirus program show up that's specifically targeting the Mac. It's called Mac Defender, all in capital letters, MAC Defender. It's a new malware, and it'll pop up when you're surfing the web, certain websites, give you a security warning letting you know that your browser is infected, and offer to download. Actually, I think it actually automatically starts downloading a zip installer file, which could then open up and prompt you to install the application. Don't install it. There are variants that have already started surfacing, so just be aware out there. If your Mac downloads something that you didn't intend to download and asks you to install it, don't install it. It does require permissions to install, and once installed, it does its thing, and you're now infected, and you're going to have to deal with that. Another thing you may want to do is go into your Safari preferences and then turn off the Open Safe Files After Download option. That's always been a questionable option. You know, once again, if you're aware of what's going on, you know you have that feature turned on, and you see something pop up that shouldn't have popped up, you know, cancel it, get out of it, and just go find that thing and trash it. But for people who just don't want to deal with that, turn that off. And that way it can't automatically start opening up a zip file and doing things on your system. There's a couple incidents at Apple retail stores that occurred this week. The first one is one that seems to be happening every week or every other week, at least at the retail locations in the U.S. This time around, it was a smash-and-grab robbery at Apple's Crocker Park retail store in Westlake, Ohio. What happens is thieves come in, they smash the front glass, and then they rush off with Apple products. Also this week, there was an incident at the Apple iPad 2 launch in Beijing, China. There were large crowds. A number of them were scalpers in line to try and make a profit on iPad 2 shortages. They were hiring people and going in and buying up quantities of iPad 2s and then selling them on the streets just outside the store. When Apple reportedly tried to limit the quantities that were ending up in the hands of the scalpers, things got a little bit crazy, and they rushed the store, smashing the front glass. There was a report that a foreign Apple employee allegedly hit a customer with a metal bar. There were images online. Blood was supposedly shed, and it was not a good situation. The Global Times later reported that Apple is actually compensating at least one of the victims $3,000 for their injuries, or approximately $3,000 for their injuries. An Apple spokesman did acknowledge the incident, saying the store had to be shut down for a few hours and that, quote, the store team acted to protect themselves and our customers. They did not mention or confirm anything about the alleged hitting with the metal bar. So the one thing common in both these stories is that smashed glass at the front of the retail store. And all of these smash and grab robberies, we had one in San Diego recently where there was actually gunfire, and it got to be a pretty dangerous situation. And I have a feeling the industrial design that Apple's come up with is beautiful. It's really nice. I don't think it's the kind of thing where Apple wants to have to install security bars, but they might. They might have to do those roll down security bars so at night you actually lock up the store. That would be a shame, because Apple does these beautiful displays to promote their products. I think they really like the openness. They like the amount of light and the overall feel it gives to the locations. The industrial design is great. I think it's very unique. It's what even Microsoft copied for its own retail stores, but seems to be becoming a problem. And if it continues, I think you're going to see thieves noting that this methodology works. You smash the glass, and I've seen very few incidents where they've actually caught these guys that are doing it, but maybe that's just that you don't hear the follow-up reports. You only hear about the initial event. Hopefully it's not a huge problem and doesn't continue to be a problem, but if it does continue, Apple might have to rethink how they design their retail store locations. And then finally today, Apple added a new feature this week to its retail site. Actually, they added a whole new website where they're trying to gather customer feedback and information. It's called Apple's Customer Pulse Survey System. It's currently invite only, but if you do receive an invite, you can sign up and they ask you to rate or provide feedback on various products. Seems like Apple's taking a more proactive approach than their current Apple's feedback site. If you go to apple.com/feedback, you can just leave a comment or a question or feedback on a specific product. This one, sort of the other way around, Apple will contact known customers of certain devices and ask them to fill out a survey. The trend overall of Apple updating their website and making improvements to especially the customer service area is something that I'm really enjoying. I think they've done a great job. If you haven't been over to the support site, you should check it out. It's the customer pulse system seems to be the latest in a long string of improvements they're making to the website. Express Lane support is one of my personal favorites. I've used it a few times now. That gives you the ability to go sign up or fill out a form for support. You can define a time to have an Apple representative call you back, and they're always prompt with their return calls. It's also the system that I used recently to gain access to MobileMe's chat support, which is another great feature, just to be able to go online and chat and get answers to questions with MobileMe very quickly and easily. They've also added My Apple ID, which allows you to manage your Apple ID. And another one of the features that I really like is the My Support profile, which gives you a summary of all your support incidents, including visits to the Genius Bar and any repair history that you might have for your various Apple products. Apple also recently completely redid their whole forum discussion area, and I'm liking the improvements there as well. About my only complaint about the entire system is something Apple struggled with for a long time, and that's all of these new products, services, and features not really being easy to find or consolidated. A lot of them have their own URLs and sort of mini websites, and it can be a little bit confusing finding the feature or the item that you want. But overall, it's nice to see Apple bringing things together. I still think the Apple ID is a little bit of a mess. I have accounts in different areas that have been set up over the years, and those really aren't consolidated quite yet. But I think Apple's getting there, and it's nice, once again, to see these improvements. And that's going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I want to recognize another one of our show sponsors, Furonix, makers of Deep Freeze. Deep Freeze is a really cool application. It's used by the hospitality industry, by government organizations, by education to help lower and reduce their IT and computer management costs. And the way that it does it is it allows you to set up a computer system, a Mac or a PC, and then freeze that system in place. So you set up the operating system, you configure it, you load all of the applications that you want to have in use in your environment, you run Deep Freeze on it, and you lock it down. Now, what that means is that the operating system and the things that you have frozen are safe, but it doesn't do it in a way that restricts the user's ability to operate on that system. So if you've had other systems or been familiar with other software packages that protect an operating system so that people can't install things that you don't want them to install or cause damage to the core operating system, a lot of times those systems are really restrictive in terms of the person's ability to use the machine. With Deep Freeze, you don't have that. Deep Freeze, you're free to go in, you're free to work on the system, or your users are free to work on the system just as if it were a normal Mac that maybe they even owned and set up themselves. So they can install applications, they can use the system, they can even change system preferences if you'd like, and that stuff will stick while they're working on the machine, while they're in their session. But the minute you reboot that system, Deep Freeze kicks in and restores that system back to the original state that it was in when it was deployed, all without any intervention from IT staff or anybody having to work with that machine. The other nice thing that Deep Freeze has is it has this concept called thaw spaces. Thaw spaces allow you to define areas. They can be whole volumes, they can be individual folders, they can be the user folder in Mac OS X as a space where users are allowed to store and persist data on that system between reboots. So that's a great way to balance the protection of the operating system along with the persistence of users' files and information. So really great software package, great for setting up in lab environments, any place where you're going to have a shared computer. Cafes, cyber cafes, and things like that also use Deep Freeze. So you can check out the product, lots of information over at the website, Furonix.com. There's free trials available, and a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. So iTunes is a really great application. It's become essentially a core application on our Macs for managing all of our media, be it music, videos, things like that. But typically, it's just set up to support the media formats that Apple supports through QuickTime and through the operating system. But Phil sent me an email and he was wondering if there was a way to add non-iTunes supported video files to iTunes, in his case specifically AVI files. The best and most compatible way that I would think to do that, Phil, would actually to be to use a tool like Handbrake and actually convert your AVI files over to an iTunes supported format. Now, I recognize that's really not what you're asking for, but if you want the most compatibility, especially with your devices, especially with playback over the network to something like an Apple TV or a Mac Mini, maybe Media Center, you're really going to want to get them in an iTunes supported format. I think Handbrake's one of the easiest tools to use to do that. It supports AVI conversion, and it works really great. Another option would to be to use an alternate video player that supports AVI and not load them into iTunes. Again, I realize that's not what you're asking, but these are the more compatible ways or easier ways to deal with this issue. So you could use something like VLC, which you can find at videoland.org, which is a great player that plays a myriad of alternative formats that aren't typically supported by iTunes or QuickTime. Now, to do exactly what you want, we kind of have to do a little bit of workaround. We have to do a little bit of tweaking, but there is a way to do it. It does have a few drawbacks, which I will mention. The first thing that you need to do, though, is be able to play the non-QuickTime supported format in QuickTime. So depending upon what your formats are, there are two main tools that you can use to do that. The first one is called Parian. You'll find it at parian.org, and that adds support for a number of different file formats that aren't natively supported with QuickTime out of the box. AVI is supported, so that's going to work for this situation. There's a bunch of other file formats, and you can get more information on their website. If you're dealing with Windows or Microsoft media formats, WMV formats, then you're going to need to pick up a copy of Flip for Mac, or more specifically, Windows Media Components for QuickTime. That's the free version of Flip for Mac that's distributed by Microsoft, and I'll have a link to that in the show notes at maccast.com. So install those two things, and now you'll be able to open your AVI or your WMV or alternative file formats in QuickTime, and they'll play back in the QuickTime player, and that's, you can test that, and that's how you know this is actually working. Once you've done that, the next step is how to get those into iTunes. iTunes will only out of the box recognize video formats that it supports, so things like MOV, H.264, M4V, these types of video file formats or video file extensions, really. And so the trick is that we can use QuickTime Pro 7. You can't do this with the QuickTime 10, but install QuickTime Pro 7, which is an optional install on your Snow Leopard disk. And then once you've done that, you can open the AVI file in QuickTime 7, because remember, we've installed Parian and it will now support that file format. And then you'll want to do a file save as. And then when the save as dialog box comes up, you'll see a radio button option that says create reference movie. And depending on the size of your original file, your reference movie is going to end up being a few kilobytes to maybe several megabytes. So you're going to need to account for this extra storage space. Basically, we're creating a second file that doesn't contain the movie, but contains a pointer to the AVI file. But what's important about the reference movie is when we save it, the resulting file is a .mov file, which is supported by iTunes. So you'll generate that .mov, and then that's what you will add to iTunes. iTunes will pick that up, it'll drop it in the standard video areas, and you can even apply metadata information, album art, and what have you, to that file. Now, I did read some reports that sometimes there are issues with adding the metadata and album art to these reference files. But I tried it myself and it seemed to work just fine, at least in the latest version of iTunes that I was running. If you do run into that problem, I did read that one of the workarounds is to use a third-party tagging software or metadata editing software, something like MetaX was a recommendation. So once you have the file, the reference file in there, you can play that movie in iTunes. But things like home sharing, syncing to your iOS devices, won't work because that's not the actual video file. What's happening is you're playing the reference, it's going out, it's finding the original AVI, and because you've installed Parian, you can play AVI through the QuickTime engine, but it's not going to translate over to your other devices. So that's the drawback to the solution, but it will allow you to get those non-iTunes supported file formats into iTunes. There's one other solution that I wanted to mention because it integrates with Front Row. So if you're a Front Row user and you want to play certain video file formats, but outside of iTunes, then you can check out a product called DVDpedia. We've talked about it when we've done the Mac Media Center episodes. My friend Ara Dirdirian, who does the HDTV podcast, actually turned me on to this application. What it is it's a media management software. It'll go through and you can add in stuff from your iTunes library. You can add in stuff from your movies folder, pretty much any location on your Mac, and then apply metadata information to it and sort of do a catalog of all the media files that are on your Mac, specifically tailored toward DVD and movie files. This is really good if you want to set up a library of video TS folders, basically DVD backups, and you want to be able to play those back through Front Row. So it's really great for setting up a Mac Mini Media Center using Front Row or potentially a hacked Apple TV. So you install the software, and what it has is it has a Front Row add-on that will go back out to your DVD database. And it also has a plugin for the Apple TV. It can pull in the metadata from IMDb, from Amazon.com, and display all that information in Front Row. And more importantly, within the application, you can set up links from the record in DVDpedia back to a video TS folder or an AVI file or an MKV file, something like that. And then when you access it through Front Row, it'll give you the ability to play that back right from the Front Row interface. So that's another cool little application. I'll have a links to all of this stuff in the show notes at maccast.com. And Phil, I hope that information helps you out. Next question I received this week came from Glenn. He was wondering about the accuracy of the battery indicator in the toolbar on his Mac. What he was noticing was that when the indicator said he had about 15% battery life left and he clicked on it, it displayed that that translated to about an hour of time left. About 20 minutes later, he looked up and the percentage indicator had only dropped down 1% to 14%. But this time when he clicked to check the time remaining, it had dropped all the way down to 37 minutes. So the minutes seemed to be close to accurate, but he only lost about 1%. And you would think doing the math that it would be about 10% battery life left, not 14%. So what's going on here? And I thought about this kind of the other way. If you were thinking about 15% battery life having an hour left, that translates into just over 6 hours of battery life. Now, I don't know specifically, Glenn, which MacBook Pro you had, but if it's within the last year or so, and I think you did state it was about a one-year-old MacBook Pro, then that falls in line with Apple's stated spec. So you seem to be getting the right battery life. The only thing that's really off is that indicator. And I guess I'd point out that I've never really trusted that percentage indicator. I always go off of the real world time, because reality often seems to be very different than what the battery indicator indicates. And Apple's always tweaking that thing between various software updates. They'll kind of change the algorithm, change how the power goes down. The operating system, you have to remember, has to constantly monitor all of the things that are going on your system, your external drives, the brightness of your display, how many apps you're running, how much memory is actively in use, and then it has to make adjustments on the fly to adjust that indicator. So it's really just, I think, making its best guesstimate, kind of guessing at it, and there's always going to be these fluctuations. So going off real-world numbers, what I do is I just set a timer to try and determine how healthy my battery is, how much battery life I'm doing, and then use the machine not plugged in for a day of normal usage and then see how much time I get. And I'll do that every couple months or so and just kind of compare and see where my fall off is. But you should be getting, with normal usage on a newer MacBook Pro, I would imagine you should be getting anywhere from 4 to 6 hours of battery life. Once again, Apple's stated battery lives, I think, are around in the 6 or 7% range, but that's really under ideal conditions. I don't think anybody really gets that. I will say on iOS devices, it's been a similar type problem. Apple has the percentage indicator there, and very rarely do I notice that the the discharge is really linear. As a matter of fact, ever since the iOS 4.3.1 update, my iPhone appears to be, and my iPad too, both appear to sort of discharge very quickly down to about 50%. So it might only be an hour or 2 hours, and suddenly I've gone from 100% to 50%. And I know those devices can go days without needing a battery recharge. But what I've noticed is after that, they start to really slow down, even though my usage of those devices really remains consistent in terms of the things that I'm doing with it. And at the end of the day, or end of a couple days with the iOS devices, when I compare how much actual usage time I got, the real world numbers, they come out pretty consistent. It really hasn't changed much. So it's only the indicator that seems to be off, not the actual usage of the device. So I would always go by the actual usage. As far as the longevity of batteries, the current battery technologies in terms of wear and tear, the normal wear cycle seems to be about 2 to 3 years in my experience, at least with the notebook batteries. I haven't really had much of a problem with my iOS devices, but there I'm replacing them about every 2 to 3 years, so I'm probably not really noticing that the batteries wear out. My iPod, I did replace the battery in at about the 3-4 year mark, so that's typically through normal charge and discharge cycles, that's how batteries seem to go. Every time I mention this next item, I get emails and I get debate. I'm just going to say this is the information that Apple says or gives out for keeping your battery at its best possible battery life. They say that you need to keep the battery cycling. You need to keep the electrons flowing through the battery. So Apple recommends charging and discharging the battery completely at least once a month. And I can attest to that to a certain degree because with my MacBook Pro, it's essentially become a desktop machine and it's plugged in to power all the time. I've set an iCal reminder to remind me to cycle the battery to let it run down about once a month, but the reality is I don't do that. And because I don't do that, I have noticed that running on battery life after about a year of usage, I'm getting fairly poor battery life. But I'm pretty sure that's because I've damaged the battery by not keeping the electrons flowing. I keep it full all the time. The opposite is also bad. Keeping it empty all the time, so putting a battery into long-term storage, if you're going to do that, they recommend you at least charge it to the 50-75% range and then set it aside. So you don't want to live on either end of the extreme. You want to be charging and discharging, and that's the best way to ensure a long battery life. So Glenn, good luck with your battery, but I think you know, you're getting normal usage probably when you look at the real world numbers. Next thing I have for you is Lyle. He has a setup where he uses an audio adapter to connect some wireless speakers, and that adapter plugs into the headphone jack on his Mac. What he was wondering about was occasionally he needs to use the internal speaker on his Mac, but as you know, with Macs, when you plug something into the headphone jack, it disables the internal speakers. And so what Lyle does to get around it is disconnects the adapter temporarily so he can use the internal speakers and listen to, say, a video or something that he's watching on his Mac through those. Well, the problem then arises because he uses the adapter to send audio from iTunes to remote areas of the house. I think he said he has two different speaker zones that he can send audio to, and he controls that through a remote application on his iPhone. But if he forgets to reconnect the adapter, then he's in another room of the house. He can't play his music without having to go all the way back and plug the adapter back into the headphone jack. So what he was wondering is if we knew any sort of way, any sort of software switch that would allow, with the headphones still plugged in, to switch the audio from the headphone jack to the internal speakers. Lyle, I don't know of anything like that. I did some Googling around. Definitely not supported by the operating system. I thought maybe there might be a system preference hack, one of these little terminal hacks that you could do to do that. I was not able to find anything. And the other thing that I thought about is even if that switch exists, existed, you would use the software switch to move from the headphone jack to the internal speakers on your Mac. But if you left it in that state and then you were at another remote area at the house, you'd still need to be able to send somehow tell the software switch to send the audio back to the adapter that's plugged into the headphone jack. I guess you could do that using some remote control software, something like VNC and a VNC application on your iOS device. That would work, but probably not the most convenient or easiest way to do it. So I thought, well, there might be a workaround here. There might be something else that we can do. And the first thing that I thought about is using a different audio port for your wireless adapter. So USB seemed the obvious way to go. You could get something like a Griffin iMic, which is a USB, basically a USB external sound card. It looks like a little kind of puck that you can plug your adapter into, and then that plugs into the USB port on your Mac. You could then option click the sound menu item, just the built-in one in Mac OS X, and that gives you a listing of the different output sources to switch between the internal speakers and between the Griffin iMic. You could also use an application like Rogue Amoeba's Sound Source, which gives you a menu item for switching the different sources so you don't have to do the option click thing. But either of those two methods would give you that sort of switching ability. And in this case, you just have an extra adapter that you could on the fly switch between the internal speakers and the external. Now, that's not going to solve the problem. If you've moved the switch to the internal speakers, you're in that remote room, you're still going to have to use a tool like VNC or something to go back and switch your audio source. The other thing that you could do is ditch whatever adapter you're using altogether and use an AirPort Express to connect your remote speakers. That's a little bit expensive because you mentioned you have two zones and each AirPort Express is going to run you about $80 US. So that might not be the way to go, but it offers a lot of flexibility. And you could also use those AirPort Expresses for other reasons, say extending the range of your Wi-Fi or cooking up a remote printer or something like that. So there's additional functionality. After you sent me this message, I thought, you know, Apple really needs to make an adapter like the AirPort Express, but that only offers up the new AirPlay functionality. So just a little Wi-Fi thing that you could connect a set of wireless speakers to, maybe price it in the $29 range, and that would solve a lot of this problem. We could set up these remote audio zones in our house for not too expensive. You plug in a set of powered speakers to that thing, and away you go. So those were just some of the things that I thought of. If you have any other suggestions for Lyle, let me know. Send your audio comments. Maybe I missed a product that just wasn't able to run across. There might be another solution out there in the community. And I guess I got a lot of email questions this week. The last one that I have for you today comes from McKay. He has a new 27-inch iMac and recently added a 27-inch cinema display. I'm going to have to just comment there. That's a nice setup, McKay. I wish I had something like that. That's really cool. And he's been using Spaces, which he really likes, and then asked, well, can I enable Spaces on one monitor but disable it on the other? Essentially wants to use the internal iMac screen, have Spaces running on that, but leave the 27-inch cinema display, the external display, static, not switching between it. The specific application mentioned in the email was running a tutorial video while he works on Photoshop and runs through some things. So be able to switch from Photoshop to Final Cut, or Photoshop to, I think you said Premiere. I can't remember if it was Premiere or Final Cut, one of those two video applications, and then leave the tutorial video running. The problem with Spaces turned on is it activates on both monitors and the video is constantly flying out of the way. The answer to the question, can you enable Spaces on one monitor and tell the other monitor not to use Spaces, is no. But because of the actual functionality you want, I think I can give you a solution that should work. Typically, with Spaces, what happens is you have specific applications in specific virtual desktops or virtual spaces, and you can switch between them. You can use hotkeys. You can use the expose style, and it's the expose style switching that I think is causing your problem. Now, one way to work around that would be to use the hotkeys to switch between spaces, but if you've put your video in space 2 and you're switching between space 1 and space 2, both monitors are going to go into space 1 and you're going to lose your video, and then both monitors will go into space 2 and you'll get your video back. That's kind of in normal operation, but the good news is that you can actually define applications to be visible in every space. So I think your solution is to place the video, and I'm going to assume in this case that it's running in QuickTime, place QuickTime application window on your second monitor, and then set up QuickTime to be in all of the spaces when you're running. So you open up System Preferences, you go to Expose and Spaces, and then you'll click the little plus button to add a new application assignment. From there, you will see that you have the option from a dropdown to set it from, say you put that video in space 2, change it from space 2 to live in every space. And then you're going to want to use the hotkeys to switch between spaces. So set up your hotkeys to whatever hotkey you want. Then you can start playing your video. You can use the hotkey to switch your space, and your video is not going to fly out of the way because it's going to be visible in space 1, space 2, space 3, space 4, any space that you have because you've set it up to run in all spaces. So I think that's going to work for you, McKay. The other thing that I wanted to mention is, as I was doing this research, I came across another couple useful applications that I think might be helpful for people who are running spaces or second monitors for that matter. One is called Second Bar, and if you've ever used a dual monitor setup, you know that one monitor has your toolbar, and typically the other monitor doesn't have the toolbar, but you can have situations where it would be convenient if you're working on their second monitor to just go up and be able to access things in the menu bar. Second Bar adds a menu bar to your second display. The other thing is docks. Your dock only lives typically on your main display. Well, there's actually an application called Dock Spaces that allows you to define up to 10 different docks. And one of the cool features with Dock Spaces is that you can assign specific docks to specific spaces. So you can use Dock Spaces to define docs around specific applications. So you might have one for your email contacts and calendars. You might have one for all your image editing programs. You might have one for your web development programs. And you can switch between those using doc spaces. And you could also put each one of those in its own individual space. So if you had all your web applications in one space, you could have the doc relevant to that space on the same screen. So that's really cool. And I will have links to both of those applications in the show notes up at maccast.com. That's going to do it for today. Thanks for hanging out. Before I leave you, I do want to thank all of my show sponsors. Gazelle, get cash for your old electronic devices. Check them out at gazelle.com. Circus Ponies, makers of Notebook. You can get more information and details on their product as well as a free trial over at circusponies.com. Smile, they make text expander, PDF pen, disk label, bunch of great applications. Check them all out and get free trials over at smilesoftware.com. Pharonix, makers of Deep Freeze, PowerSave Mac. Check out their stuff. Get demos over at pharonix.com. And Stitcher, Stitcher Radio, a cool application for iOS that allows you to stream podcasts and radio. You can find more information and details over at stitcher.com/maccast. Get a link to download the application. And right now, if you sign up with Stitcher and use the code MACCAST, you can get entered in a contest to win a free iPad 2. So thanks to all those sponsors for their support of the MACCAST. Thanks to you for your support. Please keep your emails, your audio comments coming. You can send those to maccast@gmail.com, or you can call in on the listener hotline, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9. Also, be sure to check out maccast.com. There you'll find the show notes with links to everything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast. And while you're there, you might also want to check out the MacCast member program. Every week, I deliver extra content to MacCast members for just about $4 a month. not too bad. Different plans and options are available. If you're currently a MacCast member and you have been for the past year, we just came up on our year anniversary. I know a lot of renewals are coming up. The memberships don't renew automatically, so you will need to sign into your account and re-sign up if you want to continue your membership. And I really appreciate everybody who's supporting the MacCast through becoming a MacCast member. So check that out. If you want to follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast, or on Facebook, facebook.com/TheMacCast. New music for you this week comes from a MacCast listener. If you like the track, you like what you hear, be sure to check out the band's website. I'll have a link to that up at MacCast.com. Also, you can buy the album and music on iTunes. I'll have direct links there, or in your iTunes or on your iPod right as the track is playing. You can use the enhanced features of the MacCast to go out and buy the album. That's a great way to support the artists who allow me to play this great music at the end of each and every show. So thanks to them. This is Long Drought by Nova Lux. Enjoy, and I will see you all next time.
Long trial, long drought. Have you taught yourself to live without? To fly, tough luck. You ever feel just like you're stuck? I can't believe, I can't.